hostilities between Palestinians and Israelis over land rights, gender wars, should women lead our military, political leader, a known womanizer, gang rape leads to death and dismemberment, religious leader caught in love triangle, child abuse by respected religious leader, gays demand their rights in mob scene, assassination of a world leader by a religious zealot, civil war between ethnic groups, 65,000 die, girls kidnapped at dance, forced into marriage. How about those for headlines? Sound very contemporary, don't they? They're really headlines from the book of Judges. We're beginning a study in the book of Judges. And the events headlined here took place 3,300 years ago and are chronicled in God's book. You know, if the book of Judges were made into a movie today, it would have to be R-rated for violence and sexual themes. In fact, the book of Judges is one of those books that Christians are sometimes embarrassed by because of all of the stories and the events that are outlined in this book. All right, why study all these stories from so long ago? Ravi Zacharias remembers sitting next to a young man at the 50th anniversary celebration of a church. After about 15 minutes of speeches, all focusing on remember when, the young man muttered, "I hate all this nostalgia stuff." Ravi thought for a minute and then leaned over and quietly whispered, "The only thing worse than nostalgia is amnesia." It was philosopher George Santayana who famously said, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." So if we don't study the book of Judges, we aren't learning from the past, God's history, then we're not prepared for the present. So as we begin our study of the book of Judges, we would do well to remember the lessons of the past, because we're studying culture wars, really, then and now. We think of the book of Judges as a historical book. That's where we place it in our Bibles. It's part of the history of Israel, right? Well, in the Hebrew canon, it was a prophetic book. It's listed as one of the books of prophecy, not history. It was written as prophecy, warning people about what happens when a culture loses its moral and spiritual foundations. That's prophecy. The book of Judges is a case study in social degeneration and national decline. So when we look at the book of Judges as a whole, what do we see? I'm going to cover the entire book today, because I think we need to see the whole book before we start jumping into these little pieces and these little stories that are fascinating and troubling at the same time. Well, when we look at the book of Judges as a whole, we see a society sliding into chaos and anarchy. And that degeneration of society starts in the very opening chapters, the prelude, the introduction, if you will. And the principle in the opening chapters is this: compromise leads to the loss of conscience. Now, we're not told who wrote the book of Judges. The Babylonian Talmud says that Samuel, the prophet Samuel, who lived in the days of King Saul and King David, wrote the book of Judges. If so, he clearly wrote the book as a moral commentary on what happens when a society moves away from God and the moral absolutes that God commands. The very opening words of the book give us the historical context. Now, it came about after the death of Joshua. You know Joshua, the great leader of the conquest, right? So the book gives us events that occurred in the, some of them occurred probably in the latter stages of Joshua's life, and then after Joshua died and continued on for the next several hundred years. So Joshua led this original conquest of the land. It was sort of a blitzkrieg assault on the land of Canaan. And it established the nation of Israel in this territory. But it did not control all the people and all the land. Judges is the second wave then of this conquest, as each of the 12 tribes was to take control of the territory where they lived, where they resided, their towns, their provinces, their states. So land was allotted to each tribe, and each tribe was to establish control over that section of the land. God had told Israel, commanded them through Moses, to drive out the Canaanites, to eliminate them from the land, to get them out of there, to get rid of them, and not to make any treaties with them. Sometimes people today, Christians, are uncomfortable with the whole idea of God commanding a conquest of the land and the violence that came about. And we're going to say more about that in our study, I know. But remember this. The reason that God wanted the Canaanites eliminated from the land of Canaan was not pragmatic. It was not racial or ethnic. It was spiritual. So when we keep that in mind, we understand the principle that God is trying to establish. The Canaanite culture was anti-God. It was anti all that God was about. And there could be no compromise with this anti-God culture. See, the Canaanites were not so much a military threat. I mean, they were that, and certainly the failure to drive them out is going to come back to bite Israel in various ways and times because of military issues. But that was not the primary issue. They were really a spiritual cancer that would destroy the nation of Israel through infection from within if they were allowed to live with the Israelites. So the conquest, if you think about it this way, the conquest was really spiritual surgery to get rid of all of the cancer in the body. Because if you leave any of the cancer in a human body, what does it do? It infects the body and it leads to death. Nobody suggests that you tolerate the cancer in a human body. You got to get rid of it. And sometimes, as we know, the cure for that is horrendous on the human body. Well, the cure for this cancer was very, very traumatic as well. The cancer of the Canaanites. And so God called them to eliminate the infection. Initially, the conquest went very well. The first generation of leaders was successful. But the next generation began to compromise their values. Turn to Judges chapter 2 and verse 6. When Joshua had dismissed the people, the sons of Israel went each to the inheritance to possess the land. Joshua 2:7. And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who survived Joshua, who had seen all the great work of the Lord which he had done for Israel. Then we read that Joshua dies and the elders die. Now drop down to verse 10. And all that generation also were gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord, nor yet the work which he had done for Israel. There you've got it right there. In a nutshell, the second generation failed. And they began to make treaties with the people in the land. And the argument went something like this. Why eliminate them? Hey, they got a good economy. They've got excellent cities. They've got fertile lands. Why eliminate them? Why not use them to make ourselves wealthy and materially successful? That was the second generation's thinking. And they chose social success over spiritual principles. And they compromised their moral values, and the result was failure. The Israelites compromised. And the plains were left to the Canaanites. And the Israelites tried to be socially successful by tolerating them and using them for their material prosperity. And that meant that they primarily were living in the rugged hill country. And you can see this topographical map. The Canaanites continued to live in the green plain areas, the fertile areas. The Israelites lived in the hill country, the rugged terrain that surrounded the plains. So they tolerated them, and they left the fertile land to the Canaanites. But eventually the Canaanites became powerful again. The Israelites were left to eke out an existence in the less fertile hill country. The cancer kind of took the nation. And Jericho, for example, in the plains country, becomes strong again and controlled the passes into the hill country. And who's controlling who now? All right, why didn't God just eliminate the cancer? It's a question we all ought to ask, isn't it? Why not just get rid of it? Turn to the end of the introduction to Judges. It's chapter 3, actually. That's all introduction, by the way. Judges chapter 3, verse 1. Now these are the nations which the Lord left to test Israel by them. That is, all who had not experienced any of the wars of Canaan. And then you read down through, and there's a list of nations. Look at verse 4 of Judges chapter 3. And they, these nations, were for the testing Israel, were for testing Israel to find out if they would obey the commandments of the Lord which He had commanded their fathers through Moses. Why didn't God just get rid of them? To test the new generation. Verse 5. And the sons of Israel lived among the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, and they took their daughters for themselves as wives and gave their own daughters to their sons and what? Served their gods. Compromise. Each generation has to face the test. And the same is true today. There are many who seek to be socially successful but end up spiritually bankrupt. We compromise our values, our spiritual convictions, because we want desperately to fit in and be accepted by those around us in our culture. Young people end up adopting the ways of society, marrying those who don't follow the Lord. The result is always spiritual bankruptcy. God allows all of this as a test for each and every generation. You know what? Can't guarantee it for our kids, can we? Just as our parents couldn't guarantee it for us. When we compromise our spiritual convictions, it will lead to the loss of conscience. That internal guiding principle that God places in every heart. Now that's true individually, but it's true culturally as well. A society that refuses to accept moral absolutes ends up with a loss of social collective conscience. A generation that rejects any objective standard to measure truth will eventually descend into chaos. Anything goes. That's exactly what we're seeing in 21st century America. I grew up in the late 60s and early 70s, right? All of those protest times. my generation is now in power in the halls of our universities and our governments. And I've lived long enough now in my 50s to see the results. We are reaping the results of compromise today. The foundation is gone. There are no moral absolutes anymore, so there's no foundation for our society. Who is to say what is right, what is wrong? Why is my right better than your right? How do we decide if there's no standard by which to judge the rights? Our nation has lost its collective conscience, and we are floundering with the results in our society. The Wexner Center for the Arts at Ohio State University was hailed by Newsweek as America's first deconstructionist building. Deconstructionist building. It is deliberately designed to make a philosophical statement about rules and principles. You look at some of the forms in those pictures. They're all unfinished. Arches end in the middle of nowhere. Turrets don't complete themselves. Inside, pillars hang from ceilings and go nowhere and do nothing. Stairs climb up to nothing. Halls and other parts of the building are made to deliberately cause you to be dizzy when you walk down the hall. It's a deconstructionist building. It's designed to make a philosophical statement. There are no rules. There are no principles. It's all gone. All right? When someone explained that rationale to Ravi Zacharias on a tour, he had just one question. Did the architect do the same with the foundation? If so, I'm out of here. Okay, that's the key, isn't it? Right there. Obviously, he didn't do the same with the foundation. You can play games with forms, but when the foundation is gone, it all falls apart. And so it is with society. Unfortunately, folks, our foundation in America is gone. King Crimson, a popular rock group for 30 years off and on, back in my day, and 2003 they were still doing it, wrote these insightful lyrics about our country. And they wrote these lyrics back in 1969 when I was still in high school. The wall on which the prophets wrote is cracking at the seams. Upon the instruments of death, the sunlight brightly gleams. When every man is torn apart with nightmares and with dreams, will no one lay the laurel wreath as silence drowns the screams? Between the iron gates of fate, the seeds of time were sown and watered by the deeds of those who know and who are known. And here's the words. Knowledge is a deadly friend when no one sets the rules. The fate of all mankind I see is in the hands of fools. When there's no one to set the rules, then all knowledge is deadly. The song, written in 1969, was entitled Epitaph, and it is the epitaph on our society. Way back then. The foundation is gone, the first stage is over, compromise leads to a loss of conscience. Secondly, in the book of Judges, the loss of conscience leads to the cycles of sin. The major part of the book of Judges revolves around these cycles of sin and salvation. Actually, let's not forget that this is God's grace still at work, because each cycle of sin also is a cycle of salvation in the book of Judges. And it goes round and round and round. There are 12 judges whose stories are told in this book. Some led the nation for years, others only for a brief period of time. Some of them actually overlap in their leadership in different parts of the country. All are men whom God raised up, men or women, whom God raised up to lead the nation, to to lead the nation out of the cycle of sin that they had fallen into and to lead the people to turn to God. Now, these are, many of them, very flawed leaders, we're going to find out. Many fail significantly themselves. But God is planting into the society individuals and families who will take a stand for Him in a world gone crazy. And He's doing the same today, by the way. So you see, the cycles of sin are also cycles of salvation. God is a God of grace, and He works redemptively even in a culture turned against Him. So the book of Judges revolves around these cycles of sin and salvation. The people do evil. They sin. They turn away from God. So God allows a foreign nation to come in and oppress them, or suffering, or famine, or poverty, or catastrophe, or military defeat, to discipline His people. You know, sometimes the only way God can get our attention is through suffering, through problems. Pain is God's megaphone trying to get our attention, C.S. Lewis said. So He uses suffering to get our attention. And the cyclical pattern shows the form of God's sovereignty and how He works in our lives today as well. Maybe the terrorist attacks, the hurricanes, the catastrophes are God's way of trying to get our attention, you think? In Israel, the people would eventually repent. They would turn to God. They'd cry out for help. We're in a mess. We need help, God. And God would raise up a deliverer. By the way, the word judge, we use the word judge to mean somebody who sits in a court and makes legal decisions. The Hebrew word judge means a leader, most often a military leader, a social leader, a political leader, a religious leader, but a deliverer, somebody who delivers the people. That's the ancient meaning of this term. So the judge was a leader raised up by God to lead the people who had turned and cried out to God. You know, a nation doesn't change unless the hearts of the people change. That's the mistake that often people are making even today. Morality is the result of spiritual transformation. You can never force it, except for a time, perhaps. But it is the result of spiritual transformation. The problem in any nation is a heart problem. It's a spiritual problem first. And that must be addressed. And so the people turn to God. They cry out to God. He raises up a deliverer who leads them to victory. And for a while the people follow that leader and life goes well for the nation. But the leader eventually dies or fails himself, and the people slide back into the pattern of sin, and they start the cycle all over again. 12 times we go through this same cycle in the book of Judges. Peter Kreeft, a philosophy professor at Boston College, follows Chuck Colson by using the law of the four C's to help us understand the social situation that we live in today. And we see it illustrated in the book of Judges. We're watching it play out in our society as well. Every society, he argues, this philosophy professor and the law of the four C's argues, every society seeks to establish community. That's what a society is. It is shared convictions, values. It is a sense of community. And if you don't have community, you have chaos. It will go in one direction or the other. And nations never continue that slide into chaos unless they get back to community. They always decline and fall apart, and new nations start. No society can exist in chaos. So we need community to exist as a society. Now, Peter Kreeft argues that there are two ways to establish community. The first way is to maintain social conscience, collective morality, shared values that bind people into community. And the opposite pole is cops. This is the law of the four C's. if people do not have an effective conscience at work guiding them, their moral choices, then society will slide into chaos unless cops are given the power to control the choices that people make. That's what happens in the book of Judges. As people lose their consciences, the only way to restore a sense of community is through a cop, the judge who is raised up to straighten out the society. Well, the same is true today. If you cannot trust your neighbor to have a strong conscience that will help him do what is right, then you will need strong cops to straighten out the messes that people get into, or else it's going to degenerate into chaos, anarchy, moral anarchy, where no one can trust anyone. So to the extent that people in a society live with a strong moral and social conscience, we don't need cops. Right? If everybody did what was right, we wouldn't need cops, we wouldn't need judges, we wouldn't need a legal system. That's true liberty, guided by social conscience, personal conscience, each individual. We're free to work together and trust one another. But when the conscience fails, then we see two young men just convicted this week in a Portland court, right? For killing a maitre d' in a parking lot a year ago because they wanted some drug money. If there's no conscience, you can't trust people. You must then have strong cops and judges to straighten things out, right? So if that process continues long enough, the law of the four C's says you will end up in totalitarianism. Many are saying that this is where America is headed, totalitarianism. It's hard to believe, isn't it? But Peter Kreeft and others argue America is headed toward totalitarianism. If we can't solve the problem of our loss of conscience. Why? Strong dictators always rise to power from a society in chaos. Because nobody wants to live in chaos. So they'll give the power to a dictator to straighten things out. That's totalitarianism, when they can't straighten it out because of the loss of conscience. And we are seeing more and more power given to our government, our judicial leaders, to solve our problems. Figure it out for us, because we no longer have a conscience guiding our individuals in the nation. We have no government armed with the power of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion. Avarice, ambition, revenge, or gallantry would break the strongest cords of our Constitution as a whale does a net. Our Constitution is made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. John Adams, 1798. Our Constitution was written for a moral and religious people. It won't work for anyone else, because when the conscience goes, the principles undergirding the Constitution no longer can control things. And you've got to go to totalitarianism and cops and strong-armed people to control things. He was right then, he's right now. But compare those words to the words of Adolf Hitler in the late 1930s. I freed Germany from the stupid and degrading fallacies of conscience and morality. We will train young people before whom the world will tremble. I want young people capable of violence, imperious, relentless, and cruel. Now, Hitler came to power and he was given power by vote of the Germans because their society had turned chaotic. Their economy was in shambles. And he promised to straighten it out. So they gave him power. What does the law of the four C's say? That's exactly what will happen when community goes to chaos because of a loss of conscience. Following World War I, in those turbulent years, Hitler came to power. And he came to power designed to destroy conscience and all morality, totalitarianism. Totalitarianism thrives on the loss of conscience, and that's the second phase of the process laid out in the book of Judges. Thirdly, the cycles of sin then, this process that goes on and on and on as a society degenerates into chaos. The cycles of sin lead to the chaos of relativism. When everything is relative, then anything is acceptable. There is no right or wrong. The story is told of a young man on a university campus who sees another student selling one of the student newspapers on campus. And the student selling the newspaper is standing there yelling, "Anarchy rules! Get your paper here! Anarchy is in control!" So the student walks up to him and he asks, "How much for the paper?" The seller says, "$0.25. So the student grabs the paper and walks off. And the seller says, hey, wait a minute, you owe me 25 cents. "No, I don't," the other student says. "You just got your first lesson in anarchy. What's right for me trumps what's right for you. Live with it." He's right. Once anything goes, once everything is okay, then anything goes. My rights are what are important. That's the end of the book of Judges in a nutshell. The key verses of the entire book come at the end, Judges 17:6, and the very last verse in the book of Judges, Judges 21:25, says, "In those days there was no king in Israel," so there's no totalitarian control, you see, no central control. "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." That's the end result. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That's where the book of Judges is headed. In fact, some of the stories that are placed at the end of the book of Judges may well have occurred earlier in the book of Judges. But remember, Judges is a prophetic book. The author has designed it to make a point. And the point is, this is where a society goes. Everyone does what is right in his own eyes. And in the last few chapters of the book of Judges, which are the conclusion then to the book, there are a series of stories that detail horrific events by anyone's standards. So what I said, I mean, if you turn this into a movie, it'd have to be R-rated. The last two stories both involve the horrible abuses of women. The first story, a man's concubine is gang-raped by vicious men. She dies on his doorstep. The husband actually dismembers her body, sends the pieces out to tribal leaders to shock them. That leads to a civil war, and 65,000 men are killed. The tribe of Benjamin is in danger of being completely eliminated as a result, so the leaders come up with a plan to fix this problem now, the problem that we've created, of course. And so they come up with a plan to kidnap, I think it's 600 young women at a dance, at a party, and force them to marry the Benjamite men so that they can have families again. Mark this idea. Social degeneration leads to the abuse and exploitation of women. Social degeneration leads to the abuse and exploitation of women. Now, the book of Judges didn't start out that way. In fact, interestingly enough, women play a leading role in the early part of the history of judges. Arguably, one of the greatest judges, one of the most moral and godly judges, was a woman named Deborah. And she was one of the most, if not the most, effective judge in Israel's history. A woman, the leader of the nation. Other women are very important in Israel's early history. But in the end, as we come to the end of the book of Judges, women are used and abused by powerful forces in society where everyone does what is right in their own eyes. Justice Kennedy wrote these infamous words in the Supreme Court decision Planned Parenthood versus Casey. At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. Look at those words carefully. That's what our society is saying through the ultimate court in our land. All right? How about this extreme case? Let's test it against that meaning. In Germany, Armin Muse placed a personal ad on the internet seeking a young, well-built man who wants to be eaten. Yeah, eaten. That's what I said. What is even more twisted is that someone answered the ad. Bern Brandes allowed himself to be killed and eaten by Muse. Later, Muse was sentenced to 8.5 years of prison, but his lawyer argued in the trial that this was a killing on request, so his client was innocent. These were two consenting adults. Brandes wished to die. Muse simply accommodated his wish. In Holland, it's legal to fulfill such a wish. As it is, by the way, in Oregon, too. One columnist argued that Muse should not be punished because he was not infringing on the rights of Brandes because Brandes wanted to be eaten. That's how he defined his existence. The individual, this columnist said, not the state, is the best judge of his own meaning in life, so he has a right to be eaten if he wants to be eaten. That's his right as a person. Now, is this not the sick, twisted, but logical end result of Justice Kennedy's statement right there? Individual autonomy to define your own concept of existence, and if that concept is to be eaten, then that isn't that your right? Of meaning of the universe, of the mystery of human life, it's your right to define that. So how can you punish anybody for doing what's their right to do? As Chuck Colson argues in his Breakpoint article. How is that different than the end result of the book of Judges? Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. I think the two statements are quite similar, actually, aren't they? If there is not a moral absolute, an authoritative conscience to judge between right and wrong, then who is to say what one person wants to do is wrong? Even if it is bizarre and repulsive, if that is his choice, how can anyone say it's wrong? Moral relativism leads to cultural chaos. That's the warning of the book of Judges. That's the prophecy that we'll be studying over the next weeks. And it's the reality we face in our society. And we are at war today, a culture war. We hear that term all the time. But I want to tell you something. Our enemies are not the politicians. Our enemies are not the gays and lesbians. Our enemies are not the abortionists. Our enemies are not the judges who sit in our courts. Those people are victims, not enemies. Our enemy is sin, and this is a spiritual war, and it will be fought, and one in the hearts of people first. Because as God changes hearts, then the result is God changes laws. What are we to do? We have to fight the battle with the weapons of God, not the weapons of man. And the twin towers of our fortress are truth and love. And we'd better be doing both. Truth and love. Os Guinness, another one of the Christians that God is using to make us think about our society, Os Guinness suggests that we consider ourselves like resistance fighters. Like the French resistance fighters during World War II. You know, the French resistance fighters, they fought the Nazis behind the scenes, right? In a world that had gone crazy. Suppose that you were a resistance fighter, he says, in World War II, and you met with your resistance leader. And your resistance leader said to you, look, this is the last time we will ever see each other face to face. You'll never see me again. But you will get your orders, and you must always do what your orders say. You must follow your orders, no matter what, in your place in this battle. You won't know the big picture. You won't ever talk to me again. You got to follow your orders. And you might look around and you might see one of your fellow resistance leaders, and that person is dressed up as a Nazi and he's arresting people. And you might think, whoa, I got to stop this. You follow your orders where you are. Because what you don't know is that that resistance leader is arresting them so that he can get them over here and release them to our people. See, you got to follow your orders where you are placed. That's your number one and only priority in this war. Will you do it? Into the time of judges, God dropped godly women like Ruth. She lives during this period of time. Moral leaders like Deborah. He raised up powerful fighters like Ehud and Othniel to stand for truth at great risk to themselves. They were resistance fighters in a culture in decline. And so today, God is raising up people to fight for Him, for His truth in love. Will you be one of them? Will you stand for God in that small corner of our society where He places you? Will you be men and women of faith in a faithless society? Father, teach us. This is your call. This is your prophecy. We see what happens. Help us to be faithful to you in the place where you put us, to the commands that you give us. And as you change and use us, change the hearts of people one by one, we pray, in our country, which we love. In Jesus' name, amen.